Okay. Another evening of questions and answers. There's a newspaper over the monastery. Every afternoon after the interviews, I go to the monastery. And there's an article there that there was a TV Q&A program with Mr. Howard, the ex-Australian Prime Minister, and a couple of people threw shoes at him. Now I know why in Buddhist temples you're not allowed to bring shoes into the hall. In case I answer the wrong way, you've got nothing to throw at me. First question, awareness, please. Awareness. Sometimes that you are aware. Whenever you're awake, but very often you're aware of the wrong things. You're aware of your thoughts. You're aware of sloth and torpor. You're aware of the food. Whatever it is. But the point is with mindfulness, we focus our mindfulness on interesting areas. Sometimes mindfulness, awareness, yes, pretty much the same thing. Remember, even in the time of the Buddha would use the local language, and people don't use language precisely. You know, sometimes we say awareness, sometimes we say mindfulness. We recognize that. There's not any great distinction between the two of them. And, of course, how are you aware? How are you mindful? As I was saying this morning, you can experience what awareness is and mindfulness is, how it grows stronger. The more simple your day, the less your brain has to deal with, the more the mindfulness can become sharp. Very often we have brain overload. And so we can't really give everything the mindfulness, the attention it truly needs to really get to know it and understand it. That's why in retreats we keep it simple. So there's not much to do. This is probably the most simple week in your whole life. Hardly anything you need to do. So that means that what you do, you can put more mindfulness into it. You just got more space. And that's where you get to know these things. And simple things become very delightful. So I'm a simpleton. The word simpleton usually means in English someone who's crazy and is mad. But simple is very beautiful. Why do some arahats appear grumpy in the suttas? Well, the only one who was really grumpy was Mahakasapa. He was grumpy. And sometimes, not really grumpy, he just wanted to try and help people become enlightened quickly. But most arahats say can't be angry. And it's only like grumpy for a reason, trying to get people to become practice a bit more, but it usually does not work, getting grumpy. It's a teaching technique which is counterproductive. So, whoever wrote that question, I think you probably mean in the suttas, the only arahat who was at all grumpy was Mahakasapa. That was his nature. All the other arahats were just so nice and peaceful and lovable and soft and cuddly. You couldn't cuddle them, but that's what you wanted to do. And in all my travels, I've told this to the monks many times, the most cuddly of those monks, the one which I used to visit every now and again, who was the person who looked and felt the most sort of arahat-like, was this monk, Ajahn Tate, who lived in this monastery on the Mekong River. And he was one of these people that the first time I went to meet him, and he was one of these monks. So just to tell you the full story. When I first went to Thailand, he was in the hospital, Sirirat Hospital. He had cancer. I forget where the cancer was, but it was untreatable. It was terminal. And so the doctor said he had the best of care and said, look, nothing we can do. And so he said, look, I'll go back to my monastery to die. And I think it was about 30 years later he finally died. So he just made full recovery. And so I think the king of Thailand built him this enormous, they called it a mandapa. It was like a place of receiving guests, a big hall about this size, and three or four stories on the banks of the Mekong River. And it was totally out of character. that this simple monk had this big building, but when the king of Thailand, you know, wants to do this, he's got no choice. So I went to see him, and I was ushered into the room, this huge room, and there was this little monk sitting in the corner just looking out over the river, and that was Ajahn Tate. It was obviously that, you know, he was put in there because people wanted him to be in there, but he didn't belong at all. He was just not part of that opulence. And as soon as you got into his presence, you thought you never wanted to leave. You felt so safe and so accepted, even though I was a very stupid monk at that time. And it was only afterwards when I used to talk to other monks about Ajahn Tate, and the sort of monk, you know, you just want to hang out with him, you just want to sit in the corner, you don't ask questions, you just want to be in the presence. Because for once there was a person who would not harm me. And even though I was far from enlightened and had some very stupid ideas, you know, he would not sort of criticize or get grumpy at me. And when I talked that over to the monks, one of the monks came up with this beautiful simile. He said that people have spikes coming out from their bodies, invisible spikes. And there are some people whose spikes are so long and so sharp, if you're in the same room with them, you get scratched. Now, these are some people you feel really uncomfortable, you know, even though they're not close to you. They're angry, they're grumpy, they've got very bad vibes. And it's like invisible spikes, you get scratched. Most people have got average-sized spikes. Every now and again, if you work too long with them in the office, you get scratched. And you get too close, and you get scratched. And every now and again, you find some people who've got small spikes. These are the people you can befriend, or you can marry, you can sort of have good relationships with. But if you get too close, you get scratched. That's, you know, with your wife, your husband, that's what happens sometimes. Because, you know, they've got spikes. But there's some people who've got no spikes at all. And those are the great arahats. You can get as close as you like, and you just don't get scratched. You feel just so safe and so comfortable in their presence. And those are like the real arahats. You know, the ones which, you know, you feel that no matter what I do or what I say, you know, they'll just smile at me. They just will not get offended. They will not get grumpy. And they're just wonderful beings. So when you get close to one, you just don't want to go anywhere. What a privilege, a good opportunity we have to see a kangaroo corpse on the side of the road. Usually death is hidden from us, like it was to Prince Siddhartha, like the kangaroos. So we will be, yeah. If you go walking to Bodhinyana Monastery, halfway from here to there, on the right-hand side, there is one of the kangaroos got hit by a car. And it's very sad because the Joey was there. They both died at the same time. And it's already fly-blown, so the flies have been out there eating it, and other little animals or the birds. And so you can see a decaying corpse there of a kangaroo. And you can smell it as well. And it just shows you, just that's all our body is, as them, so us. Sure, it's a different species, but we share so much of genetic code. And those cute little animals, the kangaroos, who don't harm anyone, they're vegetarians, and they just hop around just doing their business. And they're wonderful to see, but unfortunately that's what happens sometimes. And so it is actually good, every now and again, to see death, because it just reminds us that we haven't got that much time. Hopefully some of you have tried that method when you walk in meditation. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. It works. It's brilliant. Because you do go through that fear. When you remember death, why are you worried about all these things that you usually occupy your mind with? Sometimes we say, if this was your last night on earth, and you knew that tomorrow morning you were going to die, how would you spend tonight? Would you be worrying about the stock market? Would you be arguing, you know, be afraid of your boss you have to face up to when you go back to Singapore? All of these things which occupy our minds just vanish when we reflect upon our own mortality. That's why it's a very good reflection for us when we're meditating. When you go to bed tonight, or do you wake up in the morning? Please remember, the most dangerous place in the whole world is your bed. More people die in bed than any other place. So when you wake up in the morning, get out as soon as you can. It's dangerous. So it's a nice thing to remember. Just thinking of your death, it makes it so easy that, you know, you can just let go of things. You're not going to be here forever. So it's great. So it's good to see, you know, if you want to just go and contemplate that, just up the road, Kingsby Drive, and just about, you know, 300 metres on the right-hand side. The SN says, this is Sanyutta Nikaya, says, if you understand one of the Four Noble Truths, you know them all. Is this correct? Sort of, if you know it fully, it's just that one is an aspect of all the others. So, you know, the Four Noble Truths of suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way leading to the end of suffering, or what I usually say, happiness, the cause of happiness, that there's sometimes unhappiness while there's unhappiness. It's a much better way to present the Four Noble Truths, especially to new Buddhists. Otherwise people say, oh, you Buddhists, you're so negative talking about suffering all the time. And I remember actually, it was the first encyclopedia I got as a kid. And I think my mother still kept it. And I looked under the entry for Buddhism. Buddhism, a pessimistic religion. And that's what people used to say, because you just talk about suffering all the time. And you know, where is, you know, the suffering in Jhana Grove? It's just a happy, peaceful, wonderful place. And actually it was one of my experiences when I became a Buddhist and I thought it's all about suffering. When I saw my first monk and he started laughing and smiling, I thought, that can't be a real Buddhist. He doesn't know suffering. Then I realized what you're supposed to do is the third noble truth, the end of suffering. If you end suffering, you're supposed to be happy. So I realized that monks who are grumpy, obviously they haven't understood. They haven't actually penetrated those four noble truths. And so the ones who are happy, you're getting somewhere, you're understanding the end of suffering. So if you just really understand what real suffering is, even the first noble truth, and what happiness is, they both run together. So if you understand the first noble truth, you understand the third noble truth, the suffering and the end of suffering. If you understand how to end suffering, you understand, you know, when you don't practice that way, that suffering will keep continuing. So it is true. You know, they all sort of meld together. So if you really do see one, you can see them all. Right. Okay, SN and SA. I think with Sanyutta Nikaya and the commentary, SA. Anyway, whoever wrote this. The Sanyutta Nikaya says that by abandoning craving and by Sanyutta Atthakatha, by the cessation of contact, this is cessation. However, it seems that with the way to cessation is the Eightfold Path, which starts with right view, which is correct. How did Paul want to understand this? Okay. How you end things, how you come to cessation. Is it through the abandoning of craving or the cessation of contact, or is it by right view? How did Buddha want to understand this? Again, it's seeing things from different ways. The way we end craving is always going to be the Eightfold Path. Now, for those of you who've heard other teachers, gone to other retreats, there is like this myth, and every Pali scholar knows it's a myth. They keep on saying that the only way to end suffering is the Satipatthana. And that is a very wrong and mischievous translation of the word ekayana. It does never mean the only way. It's very bad Pali, and sometimes people, they know it doesn't mean that, but they say it anyway, just to present their own take on the Satipatthana. The only way, the Buddha said this many times, the only way to actually end suffering is the Eightfold Path. It's the Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path. Said many, many times. So if you want to reach cessation, it has to be the Eightfold Path, all the time, Eightfold Path. Not a Sevenfold Path. You can't take out any one of those factors and try to simplify it for yourself. The Buddha was so compassionate that if one of those factors wasn't necessary, he would have taken it out for you. And he would have given you a sevenfold path. He didn't add extra factors on to make life more difficult for you. He made it as simple as possible. So it is an eightfold path. That's how it works. And does it start with right view? Yes and no, because all those eight factors, you know, you put a bit of this and a bit of that, and first of all, you just develop your Eightfold Path just in a totally unsystematic order. Like in my own life, it was meditation came first, before any precepts. I was meditating and still drinking alcohol, messing around with girlfriends. And if I didn't have to pay on the buses, and if they didn't ask me for the fare, I didn't feel I needed to pay it. But when I started meditation, that got mindfulness and wisdom coming up, and I saw the dangers in taking alcohol and the benefits of not taking it, I just didn't feel good about not paying the fare on the bus. Even if the conductor never asked for it, I'd still pay anyway. And I remember just all of those precepts, they just came just by being aware, by waking up. And what are you taking alcohol for? Not even dogs drink alcohol. And so what do you do it for? It's just peer pressure. That's because everyone else says you should drink it. But when you really look at it and think, what's the point of that? It's expensive. And it's not good for your health. For those of this is 3 or 4 years ago, there was a myth going around that red wine was good for your health. And that myth was overturned a couple of years ago. Because someone looked at the stats again. And the original research came from California, where they looked at people who drank red wine and people who didn't drink. It was red wine and didn't drink red wine. And they saw that the people who drank red wine in California had far less incidence of heart disease. And for many years they said, drinking red wine is good for your heart. But then someone actually had a deeper look at the statistics. Because the people who drank red wine in California were the ones in the higher socio-economic bracket. The same sort of people who could afford to go to the gym. The people who could afford good health care, had better insurance. And when they actually looked at those research again and say the people in the same economic bracket, and those in that economic bracket who drank red wine and didn't drink red wine. And then it was quite clear that drinking the red wine was actually bad for your health. It was just the case that those who drank wine, red wine, were more wealthy, and it was their greater wealth which was creating the better health, not the wine. In the same way that some years ago, tobacco companies published research that showed that people who smoked cigarettes had a far less incidence of Alzheimer's disease. And they published this result. If you smoke, a significant decrease in the chance of getting Alzheimer's disease. Until somebody pointed out the reason was that people who smoke don't live long enough to get Alzheimer's disease. That was the reason why. So you've got to be careful on these statistics. So the red wine was actually bad for your health. It was actually the fact that people who drank red wine were healthier than other people, than were wealthier. And it was the wealth which was creating the health differential. So it's the Eightfold Path. And so I saw that for myself. And I still remember going to the Thai temple. I've been going to the Thai temple listening, because that's the nearest temple where I lived in London. And one day they took me aside, one of the monks, and said, you've been coming to the temple regularly. It's about time you took the 5 precepts. And I asked him, what are the 5 precepts? I never heard the 5 precepts before. And he said, not killing, not stealing, not committing adultery, not lying, not taking alcohol and drugs. And I looked at him and said, what do I need to take them for? I've been keeping them for over a year now. I was a vegetarian, so I never killed anything. I'd always pay everything straight up, even if I wasn't asked for it. If I got the wrong change in the shop, I would actually tell them, look, you give me too much back. So here it's back again. I was always dead honest. Yeah, and I was heterosexual, so I had a girlfriend, but we only have one at a time. It's common sense. And I would never lie, and of course I gave up alcohol and didn't take drugs anyway. So I told the monk, sir, I don't need to take the 5 precepts, I'm keeping them already. And he laughed, because I discovered them myself, just out of wisdom. So Now, the right view, for me, it was meditation gave rise to all my precepts. And then mindfulness and right view all came from that. So I started with meditation. Other people, they start with faith, they read Buddhism and think, oh, this makes really sense. And then they start sort of practicing meditation and keeping precepts. So the Eightfold Path can actually start in any place and you'll build it up as it goes along. But when it comes to the cessation of everything, it is by abandoning, you do the Eightfold Path and that allows you to let go, abandoning craving, to really let go big time. And of course, when you let go at the end of this birth, when it's your last birth, because you don't crave anymore, then you don't create the consciousness. Which somebody was saying the other day in the questions. Consciousness creates will creates consciousness. Because there's no more craving, there's no more will, you don't create consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness, then there's the cessation of this contact, this sensory activity. And that's actually how it really works. And that's actually how you end. So it is abandoning craving. That's actually, the Eightfold Path comes first. So the Eightfold Path, you abandon craving. And by abandoning craving, at the end of your life, contact ceases. So that's the explanation. Just getting in the right order. Dear Ajahn, if noise is not a problem, then why are you meditating in a cave? It's actually to escape from you guys, because it's not just noise, it's just people just, you know, putting your hand on your shoulder and shaking and stuff like that. The Buddha in the Sutras taught yogis to practice meditation in a quiet place. Today I was enjoying the bliss to be until the cell phone rang. My question is, who should be protecting? Who should be protecting in the meditation hall? Yeah. Please keep your cell phones out of the meditation hall. That was a sort of a wrong thing to do. But we give forgiveness. Never mind. You're not going to be blacklisted and not allowed to go on the next retreat. Maybe I should frisk people as they come into this retreat and confiscate all your cell phones and Blackberries. And actually, I was quite surprised you get a signal. Because the signal strength here is really, really weak. And that's one of the reasons we built this place here. It's got not very good coverage. So I don't know how you got that signal. But nevertheless, you did. But you must have had good weather conditions. But again, the reason is even in a cave, you can't get it absolutely quiet. There's always some sound there. And that's the most important. You try and be as quiet as you possibly can. So please try and be quiet in this room. But you will never reach perfection in quietness. And that's one of the problems. No matter how quiet it is, there's always somebody making a noise. I'll prove it now. Quite a few of you have already gone, You can't stop it. Now, if you've got a body, you make a noise. And whoever wrote that question, you've made a lot of noise as well during this retreat. So don't just blame other people. You know, you're also, or you are a culprit as well. And I'm a culprit. Everyone makes noise. So we can't be perfect, but we want to try and make it as less as possible. But when it does happen, again, just let it go. Don't disturb and don't think about it. Because there's no such thing as saying the only place we can get full peace and quiet, no noise at all, is in your coffin. That's really quiet then. So if you really want some peace and quiet. I have lots of dreams every night. This happens when I sleep too much. Is it normal? Thank you. Apparently it is so that most of the dreams happen just before you wake up. It's your brain is becoming active again. In other words, you know, the brain has rested. So you don't, you know, what it's telling you is that you've already slept enough. Now get up. The brain says, you know, I want to get up, I want to work, I want to sort of do things. And that's when you start dreaming. So that's one reason. That's the dreams you have early in the morning, which shows, you know, you're sleeping a bit too much. And one of the nice things of this retreat, it doesn't matter what time you wake up in the morning. You can get up. 2 o'clock in the morning. You just wait and meditate. And if you made a big mistake and it's a wrong time to get up, just go to bed again. So on this retreat, any time of the day you can get up, or night, and any time of the day or night you can go to bed. It's brilliant. So it means that sometimes at night time, you know, everything, all the causes and conditions come up and you feel energy. So you meditate. And then, you know, if you feel that, you know, you meditate from 2 to 4 or 5 or 6 or something, then you can go and take a sleep. Go and take a rest. Even if you miss your breakfast. Look, lunch, you get so much for lunch. So it doesn't matter if you really miss your breakfast. You can catch up at lunchtime. So that way you don't have to be afraid of time. You don't need to be a prisoner of time. If you've got energy, use it any time of the day or night. If you feel tired, any time of the day or night, you can rest. And I found that so helpful. Because sometimes, you know, when I was a young monk, you'd have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes, 9 and 10 o'clock, your meditation was going really well. You know, perfectly alert and bright and things are happening. So I'd better go to bed now, because I've got to get up at 3. So you break all the meditation. And sometimes at 3, you get up, and really, I shouldn't have been up. I should have been in bed. It was just too early. So you spend the whole morning meditation, nodding backwards and forwards, trying to wake up, and you couldn't, because you didn't have enough sleep, and it was really unhealthy. So when you keep things natural, you know, you have enough awareness and kindness, you know when you want to sleep and you rest, and you know when you want to sort of wake up, and you wake up, and you meditate. Keep it natural, and you get a much easier meditation. You feel healthy, you feel relaxed. So just in the same way that you shouldn't get up when you're tired, also you shouldn't sleep when you're awake. So keep it natural, and you find the body balances, and you have a great time. And those people who don't like noise, 2 o'clock in the morning, this place is so quiet. So try it. In photos of Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mun, you, your monks, always sit so straight when in meditation. Does one automatically straighten up when in deep meditation? Yeah, usually. Because I remember just once I was tired and I was just slumped over. Because that's what happens when you're tired, it's just natural. And my mind started to wake up, I started to get some mindfulness. And the first time this happened, it really shocked me. I was just starting to watch my breath. My back straightened up. And that was spooky. I didn't do that. I never gave the order. It did it by itself. And the first time those sorts of things happen to you, you think, what's going on? Because I thought I was always in control. My body did it automatically. And from that time on, I always trusted my body. If it really wants to slump, let it slump. If it wants to straighten up, let it straighten up. Your body is smart. I was telling someone in their interview, this is an important part in meditation, so pay attention to this one. Sometimes when you're meditating, your body will move. And sometimes it will move, your head will go down, or you'll start twisting around. And sometimes people, you know, you don't know that's happening often. Sometimes you do. And the classic case I was saying, in one meditation retreat quite a few years ago, I opened my eyes at the end of my meditation, somebody was still sitting, and their body was just twisted right the way around. Much more than this, I can't do this. It was, you know, put me in hospital if I did what she did. And I was, you know, I was a teacher, I was really concerned for her. And I thought, my goodness, you know, she's going to sort of, you know, have to leave this place in an ambulance or something. And afterwards, I was waiting for her to come out and say, are you okay? She said, I feel great. I feel wonderful. I said, I was watching your meditation. You were twisted about, was I? And she didn't know about it, but she felt great. And so I asked her more information. She'd been in a car crash and really badly injured her back. And she said, now I feel great. And I realized this was the extreme example of many instances. Any injuries or ill health you have, when you get to that certain state of meditation where you really let go of your body and go into, say, the breath or go into nimittas, your body has a chance to heal itself. Your body knows what the best posture is. And sometimes it's ridiculous postures, like that person twisted around. But the body knew that's what it needed to get the energies flowing to do some healing. And so that's what it did. Sometimes you feel like you've got to twist a little bit or put your head to one side. And it just does it. And you feel so good afterwards. And that's a sign that, yeah, healing has happened. It shows that your body is very smart and wise. So you get out of the way and let your body heal itself. If you have these strange positions, you think, no, this is not right, it's not according to the book. And you change, you stop this wonderful opportunity for the healing power of meditation to happen. So if the body goes in weird places, let it. And you feel so relaxed and warm afterwards. It shows that some healing has happened. I saw many Buddhist friends spending too much time in temples or monasteries, thus neglecting duties in the family and what should be the priorities of lay devotees like us. Should there be a middle path supporting temple activities and also perform duties as husbands, wives and mothers? Yeah, I mean, you've got your lay duties, so you have to complete those. But if you're very wise and sharp, you find by going to the temple, especially inspiring yourself and learning good Dhamma and maybe meditation, it means you can do your duties at work and to your family much better. As someone just told me during interviews that their wife told them, if you really get upset, you know, I will pay your ticket to go and stay with Ajahn Brahm. What they were saying there is that they realized that going to the temple is in their interest. And so if you go to a good temple and learn some good Dhamma and meditate and inspire yourself, you can perform your duties in your family much better. You can perform the duties at work with more efficiency. Now, you all know the problems at work very often are not sort of the jobs you have to do, it's dealing with the people you have to work with. The office politics, you know, the people shouting at you. And if people would actually be sent to a retreat, the office would be a much more harmonious place to stay in. Many years ago, when I was travelling in Thailand, somebody gave me a Bangkok Post. I think it was on the weekend edition. It was a big article about the Oriental Hotel on the river in Bangkok. It was, you know, in those days they didn't have 6-star hotels. It was a 5-star hotel. And that year it won an award for the best hotel in the world. It always was, you know, one of the top echelon hotels. And this year it won the award. And so they had an article, they'd interviewed the manager about why they'd won that award. And one of the strategies, the very unique strategies this hotel used, was to send every one of their staff, from the cleaners to the concierge to the cooks, everyone they sent to a Buddhist monastery for a retreat every year at the hotel's expense. That was actually to Suan Mok, Buddhadasa's monastery. They sent everybody there. You know, not at the same time, obviously, you know, on roster. Not taking time off their holidays. And then the person interviewing said, was this just to convert them to being Buddhist? He said, no. So this is just sheer good business sense. Because I find if I send them for 5 days to the monastery for some meditation, they're much healthier, they don't take so much sick leave, they're much more harmonious to each other and more sensitive to the guests. He said they think this is the main reason why he won the award for the best hotel in the world that year. I should have kept that article and you should have taken that to your boss and say, look, coming to Jhana Grove every year is actually good for the business. You should pay for this. So sometimes actually coming to the temple is good for your health. I don't know how many offices and stuff there was. Just this week, a couple of days ago, there was an invitation to go to the Australian Taxation Office in Northbridge in Perth, you know, for me to give them a talk again. So why do they do this? It's because I'm good for their business. You know, you sort of lessen a lot of stress in the office. You know, you teach them a bit of meditation. They love it. So in the ATO's Australian Taxation Office, you know, the Inland Revenue part of Australia. So obviously coming to the temple, learning some meditation, spending some time there is great for your family. So it's just finding the right amount. not too much, not too little. But none at all is bad for your family. Can the body become jealous of the mind? It's an interesting question. My mind is becoming very peaceful. The body seems to want more attention in a variety of ways with metta. Yeah, that's very good. Yes, probably can do, because you know, sometimes your body is used to the attention. Which is why sometimes when my body gets a bit jealous, I say, sorry mate, you're none of my business now. I've looked after you long enough, now I'm going to look after my mind. If it throws a tantrum, I just totally ignore it. So now my body knows, when I'm going to let it go, there's no way it's going to catch me. So just let your body go. It's like this lady who was meditating, this Australian girl. She had two young children. And she told me this story that it was so hard to meditate at home. As soon as she sat down, her little girl, maybe 4 years old, would climb all over her and pull her hair. Mummy, mummy, I want a glass of water. Mummy, mummy, mummy. She had maybe a 3-year-old or 2-year-old boy. Mummy, 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 I need you. Mummy, mummy, mummy. And she'd always get up and look after her kids, because mothers are very, very attached and concerned about their children. But once she got so frustrated, she never had any time to meditate. She said, right, this is it. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to meditate. I don't care what my kids do. After 2 minutes, her daughter climbed all over her, pulled her long hair. Mummy, 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 I need a glass of water. She didn't move. She didn't say anything. Mummy, mummy, I need a glass of water. She didn't move at all. And so kids, it's amazing how clever kids are. They started, you know, sort of trying some real strategies. Mummy, 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 Richard had turned on the gas tap. Mummy, 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 Sarah's got a big knife out of the kitchen. Mummy, mummy, mummy. But she totally ignored them. If they were to cut each other up, blow up the house, so be it. And after a few minutes, it went quiet. They'd either murdered each other or something else had happened. And she sat for half an hour, and when she came out of meditation after half an hour, her two kids were playing quietly in the corner, perfectly healthy. The house was still intact. They were just kids just trying to get attention of mummy, and mummy was smart enough to say, no, I'm going to meditate. And now, when mummy meditates, the kids just play quietly. They know that there's no way they can get their mummy. And they train their kids, and the kids are fine. So, same with your body. You know, mummy, 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 scratch me. Mummy, 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 I really do need to be moved. Mummy, mummy, give me a glass of water. Mummy, mummy, so swallow my saliva. Mummy, mummy. You just say, shut up, I'm not paying any attention. And after a while, the body stops asking all these questions. And it just disappears. And when you come out afterwards, the body is fine. Just like the two kids. So it's just like a bluff. If you don't move, my leg is going to get so stiff it's going to be amputated. So it's the body just, you know, trying to sort of grab the mind. So after a while, you know the body's okay. You looked after it, okay. You look after yourself, I'm looking after the mind now. Bye-bye, body. Dear Bhante, on the fifth day of last year's retreat, I saw this beautiful blue oval-shaped light with flashing pink lights inside. It was as if the pink lights were alive. So much joy I cried. Oh, that's wonderful. It's just an imitator. Today, the sixth day, I saw this bright yellowish light, so bright that I felt warm on my face. Cannot remember joy. Both occasions lasted only a few seconds. Ah, are they imitators? Yeah, those were imitators, beautiful lights. Especially the first one, you felt so much joy and happiness, because that's usual the case with nimittas. Sometimes you get these nimittas, you don't feel so much joy and happiness. That's one of the reasons they don't last long at all. Because you haven't developed enough sort of oomph and energy in your mindfulness. When they come up, oh, it's really beautiful, oh, really nice. Give me more. Oh, yeah. This is nice. But you don't say those things, but that's sometimes what it feels like. And you have a nice time there. So yeah, they are. So, now you've had those nimittas once or twice, you want them again. And because you want them, they will never come. So remember, let go of all wanting, create peace. This is what happens when the mind becomes still. So when they come, let them be. There's that very famous simile, Ajahn Chah and the Still Forest Pool. And this is not in the book, which, you know, this monk is one of the notorious monks. He wrote about, used that as a title, but the real simile of Ajahn Chah's Still Forest Pool, as I remember it, because I lived with Ajahn Chah for 9 years, he said that when he was the wandering monk, living in the jungles, just wandering from place to place, you'd always have to find some water in the evening or late afternoon, you know, to bathe, because it's very sticky in the hot sort of climate of Thailand, to bathe, maybe wash out a robe, and to get water for drinking, to filter it. So he'd always aim to get to a river or a lake sometime around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then after bathing, washing a robe or two, filling up your water container, then you set up your mosquito net, the special umbrella mosquito net the Thai forest monks used to have, maybe about, you know, 10, 20 meters away from the water's edge. Because too close and all the animals would, you know, disturb you. And then he'd meditate, and sometimes he'd keep his eyes open at night just to see the animals come out to play. You know, before Nature Channel, this is what you could do yourself, and you'd have great fun watching the animals. I remember watching animals play, and it was just so entertaining. In one place in the north of Thailand I stayed, you know, my wooden hut had a big hole in its side, you know, like a knot in the wood, which had fallen out. And so I could look at these animals. In the afternoon I'd put a basin of water out for the birds. And this was like, you know, jungle places. And I was so amazed that the birds soon knew there was some water there for drinking and washing. And they would come every evening. But I've never seen this before. Those birds stood in line. They stood in queue. First come was first, and the other ones waited patiently in line, in a whole line of little birds of different species, waiting for their water. It's so cute. But just like human beings, there's always one bird who tries to jump the queue. And when that bird would try and jump the queue and miss his turn, all the other birds would jump on him, peck him and drive him away. It was so funny. So it's all these antics of animals in the jungle, in the wild, which are just, they're so cute. So Ajahn Chah would sometimes watch these animals at night time. But it'd have to be very quiet and very still. Because if the animals knew there was a human being there, they'd be terrified. Because most of the human beings in that jungle were hunters. And they would kill those animals, even tigers. So the animals were very scared. And when they came out of the jungle, they would look around and sniff. And if they detected a human being like an Ajahn Chah, they would run away again and not come out. But if he sat perfectly still, the animals wouldn't know he was there. They'd come out, drink, and play by the forest pool to his delight. And then I remember him saying that sometimes, he sat so still, so perfectly motionless, that these animals came out, who were so beautiful and so rare. Animals his parents and teachers had never told him about. Rare and beautiful animals, which were so sensitive, that if he just said, "Wow," or "Look at that," the animals would know and would run away and never come out again for days. He used that as a simile. The ordinary animals are the nimittas. Only if you sit perfectly still will they come out to play by your still forest pool of a mind. But if you move, those nimittas go back into the forest again. And some of you had those experiences. The light comes up, and it disappears again. You've moved. It's like the nimitta is an animal, and they know there's someone there watching you. But when you're very, very still, the nimitta comes out, doesn't know you're there, and plays around, and you enjoy it, and it's so much fun. And if you really are still, then the jhanas come out to play. these beautiful, rare animals, which are so sensitive that if you react at all, they'll run back into the forest and not come out again for days. So if you want to get those deep meditations, you've got to imagine yourself like Ajahn Chah, sitting perfectly still. So these things which come into your mind don't know there's anyone there watching. And then they stay with you. You move. You move even slightly, raise an eyebrow. They know you're watching. You have to let it be still. And then they come out. That's a simile of the still forest pool. And it's a brilliant one because it really explains it totally. Can I be a practicing Buddhist lay person and have the occasional alcoholic drink? Well, you know, you've got to be compassionate sometimes. And so just, you know, a little bit of alcohol, it doesn't really matter. A little bit of murder, the first piece, it doesn't matter. Just a little bit of adultery. You know, it's only a little bit. Doesn't matter. Why is the little bit only applied to the fifth precept and alcohol? I think I've answered the question. How can I trust you when you say I'm beautiful? You find shit beautiful too. Oh my goodness. Oh, I've been found out. Nah, just a joke. Still I've found it. Thank you for your teachings. Very good, yeah. If I find shit beautiful, all of you are just gorgeous. Very good. Is there any significance of new moon and full moon day where Buddhist ceremonies are held? Is it just tradition or science? Just tradition, because in the days before newspapers, radios, calendars, SMSs, you know, that's how you found the time. So a full moon day was obviously a great day to go out into the forest because you can actually see where you're going. So you know, that was probably the first times a full moon were the major sort of festivals for the evening. During the day, people would be just too busy getting their food, surviving. And from there, just maybe once a month wasn't enough, so you get the heart, the new moon. At least you could tell in the sky when the new moon was. You didn't need to sort of have a calendar or any sort of machine to tell you what the time was or the day was. You could see in the sky. So new moons and full moons, that was pre-Buddhist. And even in Christianity, you know, Easter is, I think, the first Sunday after the full moon of May, April or something. So, you know, the Christians use the lunar calendar as well. But it's just tradition, ancient traditions. Two of my friends have gone beyond fourth jhana. They can read their own past and future lives. Future lives? I've heard people say that, but that doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever, because the future is totally uncertain. People think they can read their future lives, but that is just fantasy, that is dreams, that is not true. And they can see through and taste their own internal organ during meditation. Taste? How they don't taste their intestines. It's sometimes, when you have got deep meditation, you do get sort of nimittas, you do get these ideas, and sometimes that they appear real to you. But you've got to be very careful here, because sometimes what appears to you in meditation, if you haven't got a really good teacher who knows what they're doing, sometimes that what is just a manufacture of the mind, you take to be real. And that can be a great danger. So, you know, I don't mind saying that you cannot see your future lives. They're uncertain. What you see is mind-made. All you can see is possibilities, what might happen. And the more you go from this present moment, the more unlikely or uncertain that would be. And seeing your internal organs during meditation, you can get an image of it, but it may not be accurate. They know others' thoughts, but not exactly what others are thinking. But more on whether another thought are wholesome or not by observing a different wave inside the heart generating good or bad karma. Sometimes a person can be sensitive to this thing, but sometimes they get it wrong. It takes 7 days or longer to get back to normal life after deep meditation. E.g., when she was back in the lecture hall, she saw a whole class of skeletons instead of her students. She saw, we'll never see skeletons here, we eat too much. You can't see one bone protruding. She saw skeletons of people and dogs walking on the street. Harley and Away have acquired psychic power. Both of them are very good people practicing wholesome Buddhism, thanks. You've got to be very careful, I mean, whether they are actually have any psychic powers or not. Usually people who do have psychic powers keep them very quiet. They don't tell other people. Basically because just like Devadatta, he had psychic powers. It doesn't mean they're enlightened. And it created for Devadatta the sense of superiority and ego. I remember the first year when I went to Wat Bapong, there was one right there, one of Ajahn Chah's students. He got some very deep meditation. And he developed that psychic power you read in the books called the divine ear. He could actually hear sounds a long way away. And of course, people checked him out, and it was actually true. People were talking in the market in Warin, and he was about 8 kilometers away, and he could actually hear them. And it was real conversations. So, you know, he did develop that ability. But then he got so proud, he started thinking he was better than Ajahn Chah, sitting in Ajahn Chah's chair. And Ajahn Chah took him aside and taught him, and the next day he bowed to every monk, maybe 40 or 50 monks there, and asked forgiveness of everyone. His psychic power, which was real, had led to a sense of spiritual pride and ego, and he lost it. He lost the reason why he was a monk, which was not to actually to be better or superior, but actually to let go of all ego and sense of self and conceit. And because of that, it's always our tradition, if you do develop psychic powers, you keep them quiet. You don't let people know. You don't exhibit them and tell others. Because it's more very likely to arouse ego and pride. So if you do get those things, you just keep them quiet. And he said, the Buddha, it's one of the great sayings of the Buddha, such a wise person, he said, the only psychic power which the Buddha praises was the ability to share and teach the Dhamma. Because that has a great benefit. So not the sort of razzmatazz about levitating or reading people's minds or doing all that sort of stuff, but teaching, so you can actually share and help other people. That's the psychic power which the Buddha encourages. Others keep quiet. So if you can teach, teach. If you can share, share. But not psychic powers, but wisdom instead. Dear Ajahn, when I meditate, the chanting keeps on radiating in my mind. What should I do? You can use what we call mantras. Mantras is a group of words which you say to yourself, usually along with the breath. In Thai Buddhism, forest Buddhism, they use the mantra Buddho, breathing in Buddha, breathing out To, Buddho, Buddho. But here for this person, and the chanting keeps going on in their head, or if they have lots of thinking, you use the Australian mantra. You breathe in, you recite to yourself, shut, as you breathe out, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. It's very effective. So try that one. And soon you'll be quiet again. When a loved one commits suicide, what can one do spiritually? You can let them go. A loved one has committed suicide. Why they did that, who knows? But if a person commits suicide, do they get reborn in a bad place? Have you heard people say that? That's bunkum. That's not true. In the same way, there was someone just over a year ago, I think he was 19 years of age, committed suicide. His family came, and they were distraught. They were Buddhists, and they thought, worst of all, that their son was going to go to hell because they committed suicide, because that's what they heard. And I said, look, your son's at university. He does exams. Actually, no, he was actually 17, about to do his end of the school exams to go to university. I said, how many subjects would your son have been examined in? I said, about 5 subjects. I said, how many papers for each subject? 2. So there'd be 10 exams you'd have to do. How many questions in every paper? Maybe 7 or 8. So that's 80 questions he would have had to answer to get to university. Now suppose he did 79 questions perfectly, and the last one he made a big mess of. Would he still be able to go to university? I said, of course so. So that's what's happened with your kid. He's had a beautiful life and done so many beautiful things. He's answered so many questions right in 17 years. But the last question, he made a mess of and he killed himself. You don't just go to hell because of the last act. All the other acts you've done as well in your life count as well. And so, the last question you answer on the exam is not so important. You have to keep it in the context of all the other questions you've answered in an exam. If you get 79 perfectly right and one terribly wrong, you still go to university. You still can get a good rebirth. And understanding that way really helped them a lot. So first of all, don't feel so upset they're going to go to hell. They can still have a beautiful rebirth. So you cannot get so, number two, not get so guilty. Because when someone commits suicide in the family, again, the first thing we do, we blame ourselves. I could have stopped that. I could have helped them. I should have seen it. And I should have noticed that there was something wrong. So you go blaming yourself. And sometimes, that we don't like doing this, but sometimes we blame them. What do you do that for? So in Buddhism, no blame. We don't know why people do these things. But they've done it for some reason or another. And blaming yourself doesn't help at all. You know, you did your very best. And most people are kind. You can't really blame yourself. You can't really blame them. So you take away all the blame and all the guilt. And you let them go. And you say, what a wonderful time we had together for those years. I don't know why you did that, but it was your choice. I let you do it. And I'd always love and care for you. And so it becomes just like any other death. Not any special because it was a suicide. And it's beautiful then. Did the Buddha commit suicide? Well, it was 3 months, this is in the sutras, 3 months before the Buddha died, he told Ananda that he gave up the life faculty, he would die in 3 months' time. He deliberately, intentionally decided he was going to die. Isn't that suicide? An intentional act which you do which causes your death. Or people say that maybe that wasn't the cause of his death, but he ate this pork from this, what's his name, Channa. And he told the other monks, don't take that, that's bad for you. But he took it himself. He knew what he was doing. No, Buddha knows what he was doing. So did he do that to poison himself, to kill himself and die? Or does Buddhas make mistakes and have accidents? So perhaps the Buddha committed suicide. Deliberately knowing what he was doing, ended his life. Now that is heresy for some monks. So you can't have a Buddha committing suicide, but that's putting it in perspective. So, is suicide that bad? But please don't do it on this retreat. Otherwise I get in big trouble. Wait till you go back to Singapore. No, don't do that. Next, can nimittas appear during slow walking meditation? Yeah, they can appear. When nimittas appear, like the nimittas are your mind, okay, the sixth sense. And if your sixth sense is very, very strong, in other words, you've been in lots of stillness, lots of purity, lots of good meditation, your mind gets that powerful. It gets more strong than the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. So when it gets actually that strong, it can dominate the five senses. Even if you've got your eyes open, you can sometimes see a nimitta in front of you because you've been doing lots and lots and lots of meditation. That only happens, you know, when you sit meditation, you get nimittas very regularly because you've got a very strong, beautiful mind. And then you open your eyes and it's still there. It's in there when you're eating your lunch or whatever. So it's a bit of a distraction, but it can be there when your five senses are strong, but only if you've really got some good meditation. So if it comes with walking meditation, if it really is a nimitta, you sit down and it really gets strong. If you sit down and it disappears, that wasn't a real nimitta. If you mind your own business, and I mind my own business, everybody can wrap up in his own cocoon or comfort zone. I actually answered this one during a interview. Then what is the meaning of life? Is this only for the retreat only? So you mind your own business for some of the time. and you help other people at other times. And that is just the way we live our life. And if you're always helping other people, you get burnt out and you've got nothing to give to them. It's the same like doing charity. You know, if you keep giving, you don't go to work and get, you've got nothing to give anymore. You're bankrupt, you run out of money. But if you work hard, and then you share your resources, and then you go back to work, and then you share, and then you go back to work and share, it's just like this is going to work spiritually. Building up all of your wisdom, compassion and peace. And here you're not doing anything for anybody. It's all for you. It's your business, no one else's business during this retreat. But when you go home again, everything which you've developed and built up on this retreat, you will share with all the people you meet and live with. So this is where you work to create all of your capital, your spiritual capital. And when you go home, you have lots and lots and lots to share with your relations and friends, and even just people you meet. So in life, we spend time working. Working in the material world and working in our spirituality. So we can share that with other people. So it's not just all about us or all about them. Sometimes it's just looking after ourselves. Resting, generating beautiful things, and then we go out and share with others. Where can one buy the alarm that you have to gently wake one up at the end of a meditation session? This one over here. I think this came on pilgrimage in India. It's just like, you know, one of these singing bowls. You can get these easy enough. Just have to vibrate it. And it gets this nice sort of spooky noise, like a UFO landing or something. And that's much better than bong. Because sometimes people are getting into deep meditation here, bong. Oh, it really rattles. So that's why I actually prefer just doing that soft sound, because it brings you out more gently. So I think this is the only one I've got for. No, we should actually keep it for the next retreat. I was going to flog it to you for the highest bidder, but no. No, we keep it there because it's nice for others. But you can get these in shops. In India, there's heaps of them. Ajahn Brahm, you mentioned in your book that silence is much more productive of wisdom and clarity than thinking. That's actually great. Does this apply to mundane life, since we need to make decisions in family life and work regularly? How? Absolutely. So if you have a decision to make, put all the information in. Get as much knowledge as you can about, you know, all the situation. Do your research. And then become silent. And as you become silent, the answers will come. For those of you who have gone down to the garden, there's a Bodhi tree. It's lost its leaves for the moment. There's a plaque underneath for Waninat. Because now she gave a large donation to this retreat center, so we planted a tree down there for her. But she used to be a social worker, and she told me one day that she came to a retreat very late. She didn't make it for the evening talk. She came about 11 o'clock or something, because tying up all of the work in the office just took her all the time. And she was, this was dealing with people with big family problems. I mean, really sort of the cold face of bad family situations. And she got her things together, but she said she had three or four really big major decisions she had to make. But she was wise, she came on the retreat, she totally forgot about them. And after three or four days, she got very still. And all these answers popped up into her head. And she came and told me in an interview, said it was weird. I couldn't really make those decisions because I couldn't see, what to do. I just forgot about them, thinking that, when I go back to work in 9 days' time, then I'll make the decisions. But I was just meditating there, very, very peaceful, and all these answers came up. And he said, they're brilliant answers. They make so much sense. Much of life, the more you think, the less you see. But if you you put all the information in and are silent, the brain just figures it out itself, and the answers just pop up. And that's the best way to make decisions. That's how I do things. Put all the information in the head, and then forget about it. A few days later, the answer comes, and it's a good answer. So silence actually helps. You get much better solutions. If we don't start out our thoughts, how do we come to a decision? That's what happens. Decisions just come. And how can we be absolutely sure that any colours that may appear is not imagination during meditation? If when those colours come, you're pretty peaceful and quiet, and if after the meditation finishes you feel happy. Because a good sign of the mind being still is its happiness afterwards. You feel just joyful and bouncy, as somebody said. So if you had a very peaceful meditation, you feel, you really feel down and grumpy afterwards, that wasn't a peaceful meditation. You've been imagining it. A very warm, bright thank you for your compassionate wisdom. Very good. Everything you taught worked, of course. Is meditation the only way to gain enlightenment and happiness? Of course it is. If there was an easier way than sitting down here for 9 days and going without your meal in the evening, wouldn't I give it to you? So meditation is the only way to gain enlightenment, as long as it's with all the other factors of the Eightfold Path. So not just meditation, because sometimes people, they come and they want to meditate and they don't want to keep any precepts. You know, they want to sort of, you know, bring their whiskey to the retreat. So what's the problem? And of course, you know, it doesn't work that way, because they want to have like a sex retreat so they can sleep with everybody. And then, what are you doing? And so what's happening is that when you really practice the Eightfold Path, that's the way to lead to enlightenment. Meditation is part of it. Your precepts are part of it. You know, your understanding views are all part of it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, may we have your opinion on the living will, please? I think the living will is when you're still alive and you say not to have a resuscitation in case, you know, you get sick. In other words, if you get wheeled to hospital and you're having a heart attack, and you can make a living will here in Australia to say, do not resuscitate me, let nature take its course. So no artificial interventions. So you've got to say that while you're still alive. Because, you know, by the time, you know, you've got your heart attack, you can't say, don't resuscitate me. You know, you're unable to say anything at that time. So that's actually letting people know that just don't have too many interventions. Can we think anumodana when others are doing the dana? Is that how merits are shared? That's beautiful. Anumodana means to rejoice along with. So other people are doing dana, and you rejoice with what they're doing. It's wonderful that people are bringing food all this way. They're cooking for you, you know, they're setting out the chairs for you, you know, that they're buying the food for you, they're setting up everything, you know, Eng Chin organized all the transport for you and everything for coming out. That's wonderful. You get so much joy, you rejoice along with everybody else. And maybe next time you can help. But anyway, you're rejoicing along with. So it's beautiful. That is merit. And I was so pleased that when I saw these, like the Katina ceremony, which we're doing on Sunday. In the old days, that usually one person, usually a rich person, would do the Katina ceremony. But all the poor villagers would come as well. And when they offered the robe, they would actually pass the robe around to everybody. And everybody would touch it, and anumodana, sadhu. And they knew that even the poor people, you know, with just no money at all, when they touched that robe and said anumodana, they got a piece of the action, a piece of the Katina merits. So you don't need to be the person who actually offers a robe. You don't need to be the person who puts the $50 in the donation box. Pass the $50 around if you can't afford it yourself and say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And then it's as if you gave the $50 yourself. It's very cheap. I shouldn't have said that. But when you rejoice along with things, you know, you share the merits. And it's great, it means that poor people can make great merits as well. So you just rejoice when somebody does something. If I sit and meditate my whole life and never see light nimitta, what will happen? No, you will, your whole life, it's a long time. Even sometimes when you're meditating, it seems like a whole life has gone before you have lunch tomorrow. Or breakfast. But no, it eventually happens. You just have to relax and let go. And if you don't see the light when you're meditating in this life. When you die, you certainly do. Do you remember near-death experiences? Floating out of your body. And what happens next? Going to the light. That light you see after you die is exactly the same as the nimittas you see in deep meditation when you're alive. Why? Because in meditation your five senses disappear. Sight, sound, smell, taste and touch vanish. And when you die, they vanish for good. You stop seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. You die. And what's left is your mind, the sixth sense, which you see as a nimitta. And it's great, sort of, people who aren't Buddhists, never meditated, they have these near-death experiences. You know exactly what's happening. You've done that many times yourself in meditation. Going into this beautiful light. So blissful that sometimes people call it pure love. Because people's idea of pure love is the same as pure bliss. A oneness. A peace with everything in the whole world. So people have those NDEs, they describe them as so joyful. And you can do that here without having a cardiac arrest. It's a much better way of experiencing that beautiful light. If you don't get it when you're alive, you get it when you're dead. This is this is very good. It's an interesting one. This is a follow-up about a husband who has a mistress. Are you interested? Of course you are. A husband who has a mistress. I had a special relationship with a young girl just after 6 months. We had only met once but had developed into such intense feelings for one another as if we have known each other for years. Was it our past life that we are meeting in this life again? My wife discovered this. After 1.5 years, and was terribly upset when she read the contents of our emails and MSN chats. We have not met a second time. Am I violating the precept, and how should one continue from here following the Buddha's teachings? Okay, of course, sometimes this does happen. Sometimes it may be past lives you meet again. But you know, you always have that in the context, you've got a partner in this life. So the right thing to do as a Buddhist, if you see, you've got your wife, and you see this girl, and it's a mutual attraction, a strong one, you tell your wife straight away. Honest to her. Look, you know, this has just happened, and I still really love and committed to you, but I saw this girl, and there's an attraction there. Okay, because that's what relationships are all about, honesty. And now listen, if that's you, and you're told by a husband, value his honesty more than anything else. If you don't value his honesty, if he's not allowed to tell you things which embarrass him, it means he will hide them from you. And then where's the relationship? Why aren't couples honest to each other? Because they're afraid. They're afraid to tell their partner. And they're afraid they'll be misunderstood. So honesty is so important. If your partner comes up and tells you this, say thank you for sharing it with me. Now how can we deal with this problem together? You haven't committed adultery yet, you've just got the attraction. And with your wife's, you're committed to your wife, okay? You love your wife, but this is a secondary attraction. And then your wife and you will get all these strategies, you know, so that, you know, you can change your email address or your telephone number or whatever. And you can just make sure you don't meet, because an attraction there, but you know it's going to cause a huge amount of problem to someone you've already committed to. So that's actually how you do it. But the main major thing is do it together with your wife. The sooner you let your wife in on what's happening, the better it'll be for both of you. And your wife will think, my goodness, my husband trusts me so much. He's so honest. And he hasn't committed any adultery yet, he's just felt this attraction straight away. And respect him and work together to make sure that that attraction is not consummated with anything. And that way you can keep together. The most important thing is honesty in a relationship. And even if you've done something bad or you've started a bad relationship with that girl, you know, it's already a bit late, but please tell your wife. And if he tells you and he said, look, I love you, I just done something stupid, please forgive him. The very fact that he's trusted you and owned up is a wonderful thing. If he owns up and tells you, it means that, you know, you've got a good relationship going there. Sometimes men do make mistakes. Girls make mistakes sometimes. But if he tells you, he's saying, I trust you so much, there is actually something there, something very strong to keep the relationship going. But just don't do that too many times. So anyway, that's Ajahn Brahm's marriage counselling. After a person passes on, where will he or she be reborn? You'll be reborn where you want to be reborn, as long as you've got sufficient good karma to get there. Just like you came to Perth, because there were two causes that you arrived here. Number one, you wanted to come here, and number two, you had enough money for the airfare. So if you want to get reborn, say, in the heaven realm, number one, you have to want to get there. You have to have enough good karma to pay for the air ticket. So this is actually how it works. You make the karma, and then where you want to go. Some people have got huge good karma, but they want to be reborn, as some people told me here in Perth some time ago, they want to be reborn as a dog. And I couldn't believe them. I said, look, you're a good person, you can do much better than that. What do you want to be a dog for? And they said, because then I don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. They had a good point there. You mean a dog, you just sleep around all day, you get really good food, you don't have to go to work or pay taxes or worry about things, and you can play around, and you know, the people love you, sleep really well, you don't have to worry about paying the rent because you know, you have this, people really love and care for their dogs these days. But then I told them, I said, if you're a dog, in the first few months of your life, you have to be taken to the vet to have a certain operation. Once I told him that, he said, I don't want to be a dog. So anyway, a few times when I meditate, I feel quite peaceful and the mind is bright. However, there is no joyfulness. I try staying as it is and usually just come out of it. Once or twice I have a joyful thought and can stay with the peace more easily, but many times it is a feeling of blankness. Appreciate your advice. Very good question, very common. Stay with that blankness for a little while because it gets more joyful. Also, to help get a more positive mind and just less fault finding and just look for the joy and the beauty in this place. You just go out looking for the joy. I gave a simile, I think, on the first day to somebody. My mother used to live on the 14th story of a tower block in London. And for the first 4 or 5 days we lived in that tower block, we looked through the window at this amazing view over London. It was brilliant. But after about a week, you know, we wouldn't watch that view anymore. We'd just watch the TV or, you know, have dinner instead. And visitors would come and they'd go out to that window. That's amazing. That's beautiful window, see, is it? We'd got so used to it, we never looked at it anymore. We lost the perception of joy because it was just used to it. And so often in our life, we lose the perception of joy as we just get jaded. So I ask you to develop that perception of beauty and joy in this world. May you've been in this retreat center how many days now? 4 or 5 days. When you first came here, it looked very beautiful. Now you're used to it. See if you can rekindle that feeling of when you first come to a beautiful place, how beautiful it looks. I have to do that. I've lived over the road in Bodhinyana Monastery for 27 years. I should be used to that now. But just even this afternoon when I walked back for tea, I looked and thought, wow, what a beautiful monastery this is. I've developed that perception of joy. And if you can do that when you go back home, you may have been married to your wife for 27 years, and you go back and say, wow, how beautiful she is. Because sometimes you just get used to her. She gets used to you. And you don't see the beauty anymore. So if you develop the perception of beauty in your life, then when meditation comes, you can appreciate it. You don't take it for granted. And the peace, oh, it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. And then you're developing the joyful mind. And then it really takes off. So that's another thing you can do. The opposite of developing a joyful mind is developing a fault-finding mind. You can always see faults in everybody. You see faults in me, you see faults in the floor, faults in the cushion, it's too soft, it's too hard. You can see faults everywhere, the food is too much, it's too delicious. We should just go back to rice and soya sauce. Now keep it simple. So no matter what it is, you can always find fault in it. And that type of mind can never get into deep meditation. So develop this beautiful, just seeing the good in other people, seeing the beauty in the world, and then meditation gets very joyful. And that's one of the reasons why positive-minded people have an easy time in meditation. People are always negative. You know those people, always finding fault with this. It's too expensive coming here. It's just too short, or it's too long, or can't we get personal air conditioning? Just little things which you pull down from the roof. And so you can get the personal temperature just for yourself, because sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too cold. Now, can't we just have room service? Or even better, a menu, so you can actually order what you're going to have for lunch and breakfast. You can always make it better, but you don't have that fault-finding mind. You're so grateful for what you've got. And then you get the joy. So develop joy. If it is none of my business, Ajahn Brahm, how do you develop compassion for a distressed living being? Okay. It's none of my business when you're meditating to think about all the distressed living beings. Otherwise, you'll have no peace at all. Even a Buddha spent time in retreats, and he never concerned himself at all with other living beings. Holy water. You're being blessed. The rain has come. No, actually, there's been a drought in Perth, so when I hear the sound of rain, it must be something meritorious has happened. We've managed to generate some rain. And it's really important too, because look, there's so many kangaroos in this area, and the kangaroos don't take showers. The only time they get a bath is when it rains. So they get really stinky after a few days when there's no rain. So now the kangaroos are going to be fragrant in the forest. So wonderful rain. So, hey, what was I talking about anyway? I think it's about helping other people or whatever. Wasn't it? Compassion. And none of your own business, yeah. You see, that question was none of my business. Yeah, okay, there's times when you work for others and times when you just let go. So you get the balance there. How many people which you talk got jhana and see the Dhamma? Everybody except the one who asked this question. Wouldn't it feel terrible if that was, you were the only one at the end of this retreat? I made the announcement that 60 meditators came on this retreat. 59 got jhanas and you were the only one who didn't. That would suck. It's very hard actually to say how many, but some do. And if you keep on going, eventually you get there. And it doesn't really matter, because it's not about attainment. At least everybody who comes on a retreat gets more peaceful. They get closer, they all make progress. And that's enough. Ajahn Brahm, does the antivirus mindfulness program work only for one bug, or can we use it to watch for multiple hindrances? Is there a limit to how many bugs it can look out for? Thank you. Now, remember, it's like, for those of you who've got maids back home who look after your house, if you give them too many instructions, they forget. It's like you send your husband out to the shopping mall. Now you must get some potatoes, and then you get some rice, and then you get some of this, and you get some of that. The poor man forgets. By the time you get to the fruit, he's forgot what first you asked for. So keep it simple. So just tell your husband, just get some rice, that's enough. So, because when you give instructions, people give too many complicated instructions, and so it gets so complicated that everyone gets confused. A good manager doesn't give too many instructions at the same time to a person. Because that happens sometimes, your boss at work, they give you this to do and that to do, and it's just too much information, you can't process it. So keep it simple. So you tell your mind, just one or two bugs is enough. And do it very simply and very, very clearly. You know, I want you to watch out for, say, fear in meditation. Okay, fear. And if it comes up, this is what you should do. Okay, do you understand? Very clear. And if it's clear, then you can forget about it and just carry on. But if it's too complicated, and sometimes people give the most complicated instructions. Yes, people have done that to me sometimes. You know, you read these manuals about how to turn something on, which is so complex. I mean, the guy who wrote it understood it, but no one else can. It's like written by the CIA in some code. So if you keep it simple, that, you know, some Dhamma books as well. When I wrote my books, I tried to make it as simple, as clear as possible. And some people complained, look, that's so simple it can't be profound. Because they think that if you can't understand it, it must be mystical. And the more, the harder to understand it is, it means that it's high wisdom. But you know, the Buddha taught very, very clearly and very easily. So not in mystical terms, in ordinary language which ordinary people could understand. So he gave simple instructions, which is why he was a great teacher. So keep it simple, easily to understand instructions, not mystical, at people's level. And then it's easy to follow. And I still remember, because I was a physicist, there's a great quote from Werner Heisenberg, you know, one of the founders of quantum physics. And he went on record as saying, if you know how profound and how difficult to explain quantum physics is, he said, if you can't explain quantum physics to the girl serving you a pint of beer in the pub so that she can understand it, it means that you don't understand it. Now, that was an amazing saying. I mean, if you really understand something, you can explain it in terms so simple that even a barmaid can understand. So, if your mind is like a barmaid, so give simple instructions so they can fully understand it. Yeah?
In the Meditation Sutta, we just can't get it straightforward.
Yeah, straightforward, yeah. So not sort of going beating around the bush. Clear instructions so your mind can remember them easily, and then it works. Too complicated, and the mind doesn't know what the hell you want it to do. Which means that, you know, it doesn't do it. Just like at work sometimes. What does my boss want me to do? And if you're really clear what your boss wants, then you can do it for them. So that's keeping it simple and keeping it clear and easy. And hopefully I've given you simple instructions, clear instructions. Just sit down and shut up. Easy. Just simple instructions. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Simple, profound, and powerful. That's all you need to know. Okay, that's 9:30. I'm on time tonight, and there's no more questions. The basket is empty. So, what do we do now? Sadhu! 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 Very good. So nice and early tonight, so you can go and do your flat-out meditation. Just make peace out of the covers. Be kind, be gentle. Or stay up later. Have something to drink in the kitchen. Enjoy the evening. And see the rain has stopped for you. Just long enough to get back to your rooms. So, I think maybe a few showers tonight, but not that much. So have a nice evening. See you tomorrow morning. Good night.